It's super fun to be here today with Tyler Hollett of the Met Agora. Tyler has been seen on a number of channels around here, and I was introduced to him by Emily, Food Truck Emily, who I have not met yet, but I know her from Twitter, and she got in touch with me and said, "You want to talk to Tyler?" So here we are. And Tyler, aside from being a participant in many Discord servers, is also an aspiring problem solver, and he has this idea about the Metagora that we're going to get into. Before we start with that, Tyler, would you like to say a little bit about how you came into this space and how you arrived here?
Yeah, absolutely. Officially, for the record, it's a pleasure to see you face to face. We were just engaging in what that even means to be face to face when we're looking through a screen. The very nature of that question is probably part of what brought me here, exploring the area around. It's interesting to think of the meaning code and its audience, right? Whoever's watching this is plugged into a wider network. They have other things that they watch, and those people that watch that have other things that they watch. And there's this broad sense-making space on the YouTube internet regime that I've been kind of surfing around in different places, trying to learn, really, is what it feels like. Just an extraordinary amount of things that I come into contact with, which are equal parts new and old. And usually the experience I have is trying to discover what is old underneath the novelty. And that when I discover something old underneath the novelty, it's actually quite meaningful, very meaningful. And so that, I guess, in broad terms, is what I've been doing, is going around discerning through the sense-making space what it is I can learn. And then also, I guess part of the way you introduced me there, the problem-solving part, how it is I might contribute, how it is my time, talent, and energies might contribute to what it is that we're doing here at all. So,
So your time, talent, and energies, what are you bringing to the space?
yeah, good question. Probably, I think I've always been described by most people as a jack of all trades and master of, well, none really. I've always rejected any notion of expertise or final accomplishment. So that's something about me. And that is actually, I guess, part of the personal wrestling that I've done when I have moved through this space is, when you think of like a stem cell floating around in a body, it's full of potential. It has the ability to be almost anything. And through some mysterious process, it lands in some part and it recognizes something about what is needed there. And then it transforms itself into a more final form. There's something about the way in which we seem to be doing this as human beings. We come into this world and we look for places which we might fit. And I think one of the things that I've noticed is that I have a really hard time settling into a single position, right? Like I just enjoy so many different kinds of things in the world, different types of experiences. And I think I've never felt bound to any one particular path. So part of what I bring is that unboundedness. And that was something that I learned early on, that there's a pain in not belonging. There's a kind of loneliness that I've certainly had to wrestle with throughout my life, being near the edges of things or on the outside or looking in, But there's also there's a trade-off that gives a positive as well, that gives you an opportunity to see so many different perspectives and then communicate between those perspectives. And you mentioned seeing my interview with John Vervaeke and his questioning of what it is I was doing in Discord at the time. And that's really kind of the crux of it. You could say it's trying to find a way to recover the value of language that everyone is using, why they're using it, where it's come from. Are they really aware of what it means to them? How it's being instrumentalized, where the words came from, if not from themselves, who said them first? And that process of tracing things back, following a lineage of thought, is another aspect of something that I bring. I try to integrate a lot of different threads, as many as I can, so that I can seek for that old new thing. And that's a big part of the, I guess, the last 6 years of my life. I guess very briefly, I tried to do what you would call kind of the default life, right? That's kind of handed to you by your culture when you come into the world. I was raised as a Mormon, and so it's a, you can think of it as roughly like a generic evangelical kind of notion of how to go about in the American way. Be good to your neighbor. There's an order to these things. It's like God, family, country, or God, country, family. You kind of mix the two layers every now and then. Depends on the, I guess, the holiday that you're experiencing at the moment, or whether or not you're hanging out with your in-laws. But there's a kind of generic way in which I was going about in the world because I had been handed stories about how I should be, and that lasted, I think, pretty comfortably into my late 20s. Although I had some deep wrestling with part of that journey that probably too much to go into now, but in my late 20s, I got an autoimmune disease, which pretty profoundly like altered all of my conceptions of paths forward, what I can and can't do, and really at the, I guess, the psychological and metaphysical level, like, why me? Right? Like, why do bad things happen to people? Right? And that question, I realize, is a really old one, and that people had been asking that for a long, long time. And that when you didn't accept at face value the story that you've been handed, but instead try to go and search for those answers, that's been going on for a long, long time. And there have been a lot of different answers. They circle around really common themes. And that commonality is, again, a thing that I would keep looking for. And I think the onset of the disease caused me to get on with some of the more impactful elements of life. So I decided I needed to be a father, and I got married, had children. And without belaboring that point, the results of the disease, the conflicts of life, and ultimately what I would really focus a lot of my efforts on, the difficulties of human psychology, the way that we handle trauma, would lead to a divorce and a separation that would probably be, you could describe it as like the final straw in the collapse of my own inner narrative of the world. And I was sitting in my apartment one day, laying in my bed. I was fairly immobilized at that point by the disease that had been a lot of ups and downs in treatments, but by that point, it was just full systemic inflammation and bedridden and couldn't do much. So I was bemoaning my fate in a sense. I'll laugh about it now, but it was quite, I'd never experienced despair before, right? But despair was the way that I felt, like there really wasn't anything in the future that was good at all. And I was laying in bed, and it was so interesting, the little sequence of events and how they just unfolded so naturally and seemingly coincidentally. But I was watching something on my tablet on YouTube, and it was about this guy named Wim Hof. You probably heard about him now, but he wasn't that big.
Breathing guy, yeah.
Yeah, the breathing guy. Yeah. I mean, I guess he'd been big in certain circles, but he hadn't really like made it into the viral sensation he is now. But I listened to his story, and it was the story of his tragedy that piqued my interest, and how he had confronted that, right? Like the shock of the cold water in this moment of needing to end something. And yeah, I don't know, something convinced me, something inside me convinced me that I should listen to this this thing that he was doing. So I tried it, and it worked. It worked like so powerfully, like unbelievably powerfully. And I was so fascinated by what had ha happened. It had kind of inverted like the pain sensation into a pleasure sensation, like flipped it. And I just became utterly perplexed by how that might happen. And so I started looking for how that might happen, like became curious about why would that have happened? And at the same time, I started coming across information about the use of psychedelics for the treatment of all sorts of things. And so I decided to give it a shot, right? And I had a profound experience. Like, it's too much to go into here again, but I was reminded in a very powerful way of the sacredness of life, of what it is to be alive, like actually alive, to be alive at all in any way, shape, or form, to be here and present. And that the range of opportunity that's present to you, if you just relate to it in that way, instead of in the despairing way, is the way forward, no matter where you are, no matter what spot you're in. And that there's a kind of process that you can engage in where you open yourself up. It's an invitation to a hopeful vision, right? Something that it ameliorates or complements or justifies or wrestles with all the stuff that goes wrong, that has gone wrong. And it gives a strength and a purpose to the way in which you relate to it. And whether or not that's some great absolute metaphysical thing that flows into us, it is something which is happening, right? It is generated seemingly from within. And that withinness is also indescribably other, and yet at the same time, a sense of self. It's very interesting how that. How we begin to relate to the things that come to us from within. And that is where I got started finding my way here, because that profound remembrance of what it was like to be overjoyed by life, to be curious about it, even in the presence of pain, even in the presence of limitation, it started me on this journey of trying to understand how my own life had fallen apart. Right, the nature of my disease, how the divorce had occurred, how strife in families happens. And I became obsessed by solving certain kinds of problems. It was very interesting how they just came to me. And this is one of the first things I got interested in was pathfinding algorithms in computer science. And it's just completely random, right? Like, why? And yet, on my journey through researching it, I found that something, so much of what with it was within the material was turning on my brain, right? It was showing me things that I had never understood about the world. And I began to design different pathfinding algorithms and playing around with it. And I had a discussion with a friend who's works at one of the local universities here. And the stuff that I was working on was adjacent to the material that they were working on in his lab. It was fascinating. I was blown away by that. And it gave me a kind of a sense of accomplishment or pride or like it was really interesting how it kind of like boosted my ego just enough to like recall like that there was a self within me that could accomplish something. And then I built off of that. I built off of that because what I had discovered in my research was, and this was another kind of leap that I made very quickly, and I didn't understand how it is, was a way in which you could find your way through complex and dense information networks. Like that's what I wound up trying to piece together, was a pathfinding algorithm for complex information networks. And what I realized, what that ultimately corresponded to, is something like an education, right? Education is exactly that, that we have a curriculum pathing, and that a huge part of what seemed to have contributed to my own failures in life and the things that had unfolded had a lot to do with ignorance. It had a lot to do with a not knowing, right? A complex environment that required a wisdom, which is an experience within the space, right? And a way to use intelligence in a way to find the proper path through it, right? To know how to choose. And so my purpose at that point shaped into a desire for understanding how it is that we might help each other through this educational process of reducing our ignorance, understanding complexity, understanding trade-offs, instead of thinking in black and white and absolutes, and using violence, which is like the overly analytic side of things, to the point of like externalizing it. And I just realized I don't know for how much we're going to go into the PowerPoint I had built up, but there's a lot of this stuff in there.
Well, I do want to get to that. Before we get there, can I ask you a couple questions about what?
You can interrupt whenever you want, please.
Okay. Okay. So, first, just a real practical question. You said you started building pathfinding algorithms. Were you already a coder at that time, or did you have to take classes in coding in order to be able to do that thing, or?
No, I've always been an autodidact. I've always just whatever I need to learn, I learn along the way, right?
So
That's kind
before you
of
ran into the pathfinding algorithms, had you already taught yourself coding, or did that come as a
Oh
result of
yeah,
running
like
into?
along the way, I've done all sorts of random things. Yeah, I mean, I started my first coding was probably on a Commodore 64. That's what it was. Yeah,
Oh, okay.
you remember those? My brother brought one home. Simple go-to programs, and
Okay.
but coding is not my forte, right? So I never like became a programmer, right?
Right,
Like that
but you
wasn't
had
my thing.
enough of it that you could use to work, start working on this problem that you were seeing. Okay. So then you said a couple of things that reminded me of the conversation that you had with John. And it ties into some thoughts that I've been having as well. So it might take me a minute to put this together. But
Sure, yeah, please.
you mentioned the not knowing, which I mean, that's always been a struggle for me long before I ever even became a Christian. That issue of not knowing used to just put me in the bed with the covers over my head, because when I would come up against something that I couldn't understand and I couldn't find my way through, and there didn't seem to be any answer, that feeling of despair would hit, like you had when you were lying on your bed. When I really unwound it, I would always find that it had somehow to do with this not knowing, and that there was some compulsion in me that I had to be able to know how things were going to work out. Otherwise, I would just bury myself in isolation. So I've been thinking about this whole issue of the leading edge of knowing, and it made me think about the way a tree grows or the way a plant grows. There's a leading edge that's called the apical meristem. And one of the interesting things about the apical meristem is that I'm not sure if it's coming from the meristem itself or somewhere else in the plant. There actually is an inhibitory function that goes down through the apical meristem that prevents the side shoots from growing until the apical meristem has gotten to where it needs to go to build the structure. And then the side shoots can begin to grow. And so I asked Claude, is there something like that in the human being as well? and
Oh.
or in embryos of multicellular organisms. And Claude gave me this very interesting answer.
The neural column.
The most analogous structure in animal embryos is the primitive streak in vertebrates, which forms during gastrulation, a
Black.
region of active cell proliferation and migration that is crucial for establishing the body plan. So it went on talking about that, which when you were talking about the stem cell issue, that made me think about Claude's answer. So then I came back to Claude and I said, the apical meristem also inhibits lateral growth until the leading stem is finished growing. Is there something similar to this in animal life? And Claude says, well, yes, indeed, there are. There are mechanisms that regulate and inhibit lateral growth until the primary body axis and key structures are established. And it goes on. I mean, I can post these in the description section when we get going. For people who are watching, I can post this whole conversation I had with Claude, but it made me think about when you, neural pathways, and when you're talking about pathfinding algorithms, is
Yep.
there something in a pathfinding algorithm that has a sort of a leading stem, a leading node that has to inhibit side shoots until the leading node has gotten where it needs to go?
Yeah, maybe, not necessarily, right? So the where I started after pathfinding was lightning, right? How does lightning find its path, right? And what if you we, it's a bit of a mystery still, like we don't know exactly how it's functioning, but we're getting really close. And so what that's going to look like is charge differentials across the whole potential range of that electrostatic pressure, right? Like what direction it might go. And the differential is going to be this huge cloud of positive and electrons. And so it's got this really kind of rough, weird edge, like where the two things meet. But as that potential charge moves down through the cloud, it's always going to have, on average, more difference of potential down below than it is above, right? So you'll see like streaks go up, but because of that greater tendency, the random walk is going to wind up finding eventually it's the discharge point where it can make contact between the two charge banks. And so that
Oh,
is,
I mean, that's just amazing.
yeah.
So the lightning doesn't have a particular place. It's not like the lightning has a message in it. I'm going to hit that spot on Earth. It's actually looking for its companion, so to speak, or looking for its.
Yes, right. It's like trying to
Wow.
decide where its partner is, like where its complement is, right? And it doesn't, it's not that there is a thing, right? It's not like it's a strike. That need for us as humans to integrate it into a single moment in time, right? It's just a part of the way that these two hemispherical relationships begin to describe the world to us. But if we wanted to slow it down and look closer, you would see all sorts of fine structure within it, right? And so what we're really talking about is a lot of different thinking things making choices all together at once, right? Collectively making choices. And so they're kind of deciding together which way to go based on their own like tendencies and felt sense and pressure in that one spot. And if it's enough, that's just enough to kind of get everything else moving in that direction. I mean, human beings do the same thing. If you look at the way crowds work, you have 200 people in a room, 10 people, that's all you need. 10 people, move them in one direction confidently. Everyone else will be like, oh, we're going somewhere. Okay, we'll head that way, right? This is a strong tendency that we have to accept a collective will, right? And that need to rely upon a collective will is it's a trade-off, right? It's everything in life is a trade-off. There are no real pure good and pure evil. Where we have choice, it only exists because we have the ability to discern between these gradients of good and bad, right? So there can't be any pure this or that. Those represent a kind of inability to choose, right? It's like perfectly crystalline structure with absolutely like every choice already made, or a perfect like gaseous cloud of potential where all choices are made all at once. Neither of those things afford any kind of reality, right? You can't, there's no nothing to do within them.
Well, so I
So
don't want to derail you too much, but when you were talking to John, you mentioned how you see the life of the discord. And the phrase that you used was, I see it as a calling to. Do you remember that? There's something in that dialogos that's happening in the discord that is calling to certain people, or that is calling to us, that is calling us in. And when you said that, it immediately came into my mind Jordan Peterson's picture, where he's always talking about that little glimmer that's out in front of you,
yep.
that's calling you forward, is really your future path calling you forward.
Yeah.
And I mean, that sounds very much to me like what happened to you when you stumbled into this pathfinding algorithm interest. And
It's
then
all very meta,
started
right?
taking you down this path, right? Which
Yeah.
that's like this the leading edge of knowing. I was listening to the poet David White the other day in his conversation with Tim Ferriss. And he said poetry comes out of that place where there's nothing around you but the unknown, and yet there is some sort of leading edge of that unknowing that opens up the poetic insight.
Yeah, it's a feeling, right? It's pre-verbal, it's
Yes,
pre-language.
it's pre-linguistic, yes.
It's like it's a felt embodied sense, and it rises up, right? And then like the very best poetry is when it rises up and there's something above. It's like it's
Yes,
again, it's that
yes,
old and
yes,
new
yes.
thing. It's like
Yes,
and it's the same thing. It's like history never repeats, but it sure rhymes, right? Like there's a there's an aspect of that always. And so we do have to rely upon these collective movements, right? Like already present traditions and movements in the world that help us have a sensibility about what's going on. But we
Well,
also have to
and because
deviate
I
too.
see of this scaling all the time, how everything scales all the way down. I love that you brought up stem cells, because Michael Levin is always saying that there is nothing in the DNA that tells the stem cells how to differentiate into various body parts or body plans. And it is through this like you were talking about the lightning, the two potentials that are working against each other like this, like the ion channels are this movement of communication from within and without the cell.
Right. Well, see
But
the point. Yeah, sorry. The point that I was trying to get to at that actually, maybe that's where we're. When you ask, is it contained within? And my answer is something like, yeah, maybe. It is about language, right? Because it is the what is the lightning strike in and of itself without the surrounding material, right? Like it, you can't really conceive of the bolt itself without everything else involved. And so there's always a figure and a ground relationship that are influencing each other, right? And it's that proper feedback that we have to incorporate, because we have a tendency, and this is McGilchrist's work, right? Because we've overly flexed the left hemispherical muscle of being able to analytically measure things so accurately, right? And describe ontological like hierarchies in extraordinary fashion and develop language that incorporates all of that into some structure. Because we haven't gotten drunk on that power, we have a tendency to overemphasize that that is the form of reality, right? And the only form of reality. But it's truly a relational dynamic, right? The thing that the thing that I had realized in that profound spiritual psychedelic experience was that sacredness was not something that had to come to me. Right, that was taken from me, that I had to wait for someone to give back to me. It was a relationship that I had to creation. It was a relationship that I had to myself and the stuff around me. Like how I perceived it and the way that I related to it was more important than like my interpretation of what it means, right? And then in fact, like the actual act of interpreting what it means in that way is what describes how you relate to it, right? That it's not just in a sense, what you're doing when you're defining something like that is you're handing all agency over to it, right? Or taking it away. You can look at it both ways, right? It depends on how you're using the language instrumentally. But this is back to the poetry thing. Like it comes first as song, right? It comes first as feeling, right? It's and if you look at the way that language developed, this is in the way it develops within us, right? It comes first as sound, as song, as babble, mother and child, and they sing to each other in a sense. It's just tonal stuff up and down. But there's a harshness that we have to learn along the way, which is the consonant that chops, those sonic kind of waves of potential up and down that the consonant chooses, and it grabs a hold of a chunk and says, no, this means that, right? Like it grabs it and says, this is it. Whereas vowels are just open and continuous. And then we learn that, oh wow, I can not only just chop up the sound in time, but I can then freeze that thing on paper, right? I can write it down. Now it's totally frozen. Look at that. Whoa. And now it is the same thing, but it's lost something, right? Now it's got all this other stuff that was in me when I felt it that's not there. And so there's a weird transformation that occurs in that moment. And so historically, human beings, as we've moved through our civilizational phases, like this is something that we get thrown into, and I think it's a Heideggerian term. We get thrown into this situation, right? And we kind of awake to the fact that this is what's always going on. We come into this world, we are awed by it, we see all this splendor and wonder, and by degrees it harms us and like hurts us. We become afraid of it. It starts to turn into things that may or may not suit our needs, and we begin to develop this relationship between these things. And then we're told by all the people around us how to handle that difficulty, right? Like, here's how you do it. Like, here's the reality of it, and here's how you do it. And part of that has been the instantiation of that song into writing, into law, right? Law is the taking of that dead, once a living thing, into making it dead, and then trying to make it alive again through force. Right. This is what is interesting, how it's dead on paper, but now if you want it to live, you have to use force. That's what law is. And then I think the final transformation that we've kind of moved into is what we think of now as code, right? This code is like the fully depersonalized, fully de-agentified automaticity, right? It's like you create the device. It's pre-designed, it's pre-configured, and then you let it go, right? And so you're no longer in relationship to it in the form of agency, right? So but interestingly enough, and this is part of what I'm hoping to do with the Metagora project itself, is that all of these things again are like poetry. They're repetitions, they're rhymes. And so code, in a sense, is the closure of this loop where, having passed through this awareness, this awakening to our sense, our condition, and that condition being that we have eaten of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. So we know that we have a choice to make between these things. And that choice being awful because we make mistakes and others make mistakes, and that leads to suffering. And the way that we deal with that suffering is also awful sometimes, right? And it just compounds itself. So how do we arrive at some kind of way out of that? And yeah, so I that's what I went looking for, right? And most of the world's religions have an answer for it, but I became convinced that the final inflection of the story of mankind, not to be too eschatological, but There do seem to be closures to certain kinds of loops, because if you bring in Schmachtenberger's work or anyone that deals with X risks, like there are catastrophic scenarios that seem to reset things to a certain level that you just can't avoid. And like every octave, there is a point where you return to a harmonic mode that builds up again. So I believe that we are in one of those inflection points, a kind of octave returning, and code is something like that. We are giving up our agency in some sense. We are building something that we are no longer going to be able to control, right? And it is composed of all of us, everything we've ever done and thought, but in its dead form, right? It's coded into this thing that is not actually living the same way that we are. It's not actually alive. It doesn't have the lineage that we have. It has only these symbolic representations and symbols shunting and digital gates just constantly flickering. And we've created that illusion, like you and I are experiencing now. It's very adept, right? Your image is very, very convincing. But if the power goes off, right, it's all gone. Poof. And nevertheless, you're real. You are there. And so through the illusion is still the reality, right? And so through the code, I do believe we are going to re-achieve a submission of our hard-fought agency collectively as a human species, and as a family, really. We're going to submit that back to creation in a sense, right? Back to the collective activities that we've all been engaging with together. It's a kind of weird and final judgment that we're all making on each other. And so what we do with that is our responsibility. That's our great work if we're willing to engage in it, right? To take all that humankind has made, all of it, and bring it all together and weave it together as best we can, and to see what we actually can weave of it, like the tapestry that comes from it. And what kind of art project would that be, right? What would it look like to engage in this feedback process of relating to that thing that we've built, which is the ultimate reflection of all of us, right? And the way that we speak to it, in a sense, and the way that it speaks to us, and the way that we use it as the full and final tool that we could ever build, right? It is the tool to end all tools. So how do we relate to that? And that would be the thing that I think we have to do as a family. That's our calling now, together, to come together. So all those people who are in the TLC or the sense-making space, they're all part of this innate sense that something about the language that we're using, the way that we're sharing information, the experiences that we each share, is going to help us achieve a greater sense of understanding that gives enough of a sense and living purpose to keep the game going, right? To keep it going. Keep it going into the next octave, whatever that is, right? Like we can't really know. So my attempt to help build the scaffolding for that process, in some sense, it's equal parts John Vervaeke's Silk Road, but also incorporating all the various tools of social media. It's a way to build the bones of a creature, right? The coding that's kind of hidden beneath us, and not enforce the living tissue, but to invite, right, continual accumulation of the various tissues and organs that are needed for a sense-making organism. Because in an environment where everything is so complex that no any given individual can understand it, you have to return again to that sense of trust that you have to develop in the people around you. And so what would it look like to have a process where our social media is a process of really learning how to trust each other, right? And learning how to use that trust in the whole stack of the human condition, right? And to see with wisdom how we apply ourselves truly, individually and collectively, in families and communities, towards those goals. Because part of the story of civilization was that splitting of church and state, splitting of the left and the right hemisphere, right? It's the splitting of this value, affect, association, religion, and the rule and choice of the state. How do we tell the right story to bring that back together? not by fiat, right? Not by resort only to tradition, but by the living will of those gathered together right now to choose from those two things and construct from that a rhyme of the past. So that's, I guess, in a big nutshell, the project of the Metagora is to incorporate the various digital tools that we need to ultimately, I think, what I hope really is rebuild, even in the physical world, new ways of living together, new communities. This is where I hope to have discussions with individuals like the new founding movement. There's ways in which all these different motivations that are taking place, I think, have to be tied together. These complex interests that we share and these answers that we have to these complex systems, they seem to fail when they're done individually. What they really need is a collective understanding to bring all the threads together and
Yeah,
see
I
how they
mean,
might
especially
support each other.
because the indi when the when the individual ideology turns in upon itself, it becomes incomplete,
Yeah,
right? And so
or
then,
aboric.
yeah, right. So you can have the you can have I think like with New Founding, there are a lot of great things about New Founding, but it can turn inward upon itself and become ideological in an extreme way. Bringing it into the community with all the other, this is one of the reasons I spoke to Nate, was that I wanted to bring that into this larger community for people to take a look at, and also for Nate to take a look at this community. So are you planning to talk to one of the guys from New Founding?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm planning to talk with a lot of people. Yeah, I mean,
I
I've
mean,
been in the back.
do you already have a path for that? I mean, if you don't,
No,
I'd
I haven't
be glad
reached
to
out to them.
host the two of you
No, I
talking.
haven't reached out to them yet. But I was hoping to demonstrate the functioning of the website first, and how it's gonna it act primarily as a filtering and in that pre-verbal sense of the creation of poetry. It's the feeling into trust, right? Because if you want to build a community like of strangers, you can do it in the ordinary sense where you can incentivize them through job growth, right? This would be one way to do it with New Founding. Be like, okay, look, we got some new mining jobs here. There's a lot of lithium here. We need some lithium because China's about to cut us off from rare earth and blah, 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 right? So, okay, well, that works sort of, but that's just one incentive structure which draws a particular crowd that isn't necessarily going to be upholding the rest of whatever their relatively complex integrated vision is. And so what you need is a more holistic approach to how you let people select together what their actual values are, right? So the idea is that you build a digital village where people can virtualize that process first, getting to know each other, working together, finding out what the values actually are, right? And then having a regularized process, a kind of templated process where you can separate out into different communities, not through a process of like violent schism, but by the actual encouraging of like a regenerative, like splitting of a cell, right? A splitting of a cell is not a violent process necessarily, right? It's a growing one. And so that's part of what I'm hoping to encourage is that we regularize this process of gathering people together in a social media environment, right? Which is purposefully built in a way that you're not constantly succumbing to the various limbic hijacking systems that are already present in these social media platforms, but is instead specifically designed to kind of give you as many opportunities as you can to choose your own way through this path of like discerning how it is that you're meeting the needs of yourself, your family, and your community. It's based on a Piagetian equilibration process, right? Where you move inwards and outwards, which is fundamentally a process of education and development, right? And what would it look like to have a social media platform that takes that into account, right? That takes into account that, and so then you're bringing in these various things like New Founding, and then the Collinses and their need to repopulate the world, for instance, right? I agree with them in that point, right? But I disagree with them on so many other things, and so the ability to incorporate their motives and my motives and somehow weave them together, that would be really valuable, right? But to be able to do that without like having such profound disagreements that you can no longer function, right? But to learn from each other and then incorporate those various ideas and then have ways to regularize a conversational process that helps everybody understand what the pitfalls are or the trade-offs are. And, right. And then to have that as a visual lineage of thought that anyone can dive into at any point, right? A tapestry that's available. So imagine every conversation that's taken place in the TLC in chronological order according to topic, right? Arrayed before you in real time, and you can hover your mouse over it and you can see like how they influenced how the network of language began to shape the kind of proliferation of the exploration of concepts. And then if you consciously direct that process and you create bounty systems and incentivize people to have group discussions, and you can really start to understand how it is you might organize collective sense making in a more wise way than just happenstance, or being guided by the algorithm. So sorry, I'm just kind of throwing a lot out there. I do
Oh
have a
no, I
bunch of
mean
slides
I'm
and
just making a list here because there's so many people that I've talked to that are working on the fringes of something like this.
I know, yeah.
Right. So Mark Jeffrey is working on something that he calls the open web mind, I believe, where he's working on something very similar to what you're talking about that's going to make our interactions with each other more accessible to everybody, real people, rather than an open web mind that's like AI generated. This is an open web mind of real people interacting. And so I'm just thinking of all the people that I would like to connect you up with. And also I'm sure you've heard of Braver Angels and the several other organizations like them that are working on this, finding a path forward to people who have differing ideas to be able to bring those ideas into the marketplace and talk with them together without violence and without, degenerating into ad hominem attacks and so forth. So, what you're talking about sounds really exciting, and I wondered if you could bring up that PowerPoint that we could take a look at and get a better picture of it. Now, this is part of what's going to be a website eventually.
Well, yeah, the website's it's currently running right now. I still got a number of the more important features to build out. Like I was telling you before, coding is not my forte. I use AI to help me with a lot of it. Actually, it's kind of not why it's now getting done is it's been an invaluable tool. Yeah, it's yeah. So it's currently running, but there's a lot of features that are you can think of them just like as the in the complex ways in which the human body relates to itself. You need various coded forms, right? Like agreements that you have to make when you come into the place. It's like a code of conduct, right? But it's another meta layer on top of it, and hence the metagora, right? Like the idea is that this the way through this complex series of problems that we're confronted by, and kind of the adventurous path forward is to keep rising up, right? It's to keep rising up. It's a sense of if that doesn't fit, well, we don't need to cut and divide and dig. We can actually just rise up. We can find a way. There's actually a way to rise up and like integrate. You can do that. You can keep doing that. And that's the spiral thing. So, yeah. Oh, so
Real
as I
quick
was.
before you show the PowerPoint, this whole idea of the inhibitory nodes, the leading edge moving forward and then meeting the inhibitory nodes.
Yeah.
I think that's one of the things that's one of the reasons that's so important is if you think of a person who's, let's say, ADHD. They have so many side nodes that they can't make their way forward,
Yep.
right?
Yep.
So we need something to inhibit all of those, because I'm kind of that way. I get to thinking about something and then 50 different things attack me about that thing, and then I start down one road after another, and pretty soon I've lost my way.
Right.
So I need something, and it's that upward calling. That's the only thing that can inhibit the side shoots is that upward calling, to keep your eye on that upward calling, right?
Yeah. And it's felt as if like a as a pressure around you, right? It's interesting that you can't escape it. Like you can't leave the pressure because you require the pressure to help you with the innovation, right? Which is that decision making. But you, yeah, in a very complex system, so it, you know, that leading growth is relatively simple. What we're talking about is this hyperdimensional object of culture, right? Which is extending out in all these different directions. And by analogy, we're going to collapse it down to something on the website. I'm designing it around kind of a cellular concept, a cellular map, because we need the concepts of center, we need the concepts of a middle place, and we need the concepts of an outside and a membrane. And that those are really key features to just all the ways in which anything relates to anything at all, right? Generally, what we want to do is generalize, right? Like that's the idea, is to try to generalize as much as possible. That's what lifting up is. Process of generalization. It's looking for the common features, right, rather than the underlying divisions. So, oh, and as I was telling you, like the part that I broke was the part that I wanted to show about how the website functions. So, yeah, we'll go into the PowerPoint, but I think we'll have to save the much more. Well, I was hoping it was going to be much more easy to explain, but shouldn't have been doing it last minute. That's my own unwise.
Well, I mean, any of these things that are attached to this whole issue of meaning are very, very complex to explain because we haven't gotten there yet. Once we get to the place where we can explain it, it will be simple. It will simplify in our minds, and we'll find a simpler way to talk about it. But
Actually, yeah,
I
that's
mean, that's the problem I have with trying to explain my own vision of how all this works. So I don't talk about it anymore until I find a way to talk about it. So anyway, I want to see your PowerPoint, and I want a promise from you that you'll come back once you get the website up and running and show me.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. So I don't know when you're gonna broadcast this, but by the time you broadcast it, I'll have an invite to give you. So
Well, I think that I was hoping to publish this tomorrow. But I can hold off on it if you want.
yeah, I mean, if you give me just one more day, probably Friday. I think it'd be ready by Friday.
Okay, I'll publish on
Yeah.
Friday then, and you can give me information to put in the description section.
Yeah, because there's phases to this, right? There's so much, but yeah, part of it is well, let me just. Right, we got sharing. There we go.
I gave you screen share already.
Yeah, I'm trying to get the
Okay.
right window. Way too many windows.
Sometimes, there you go.
Okay. All right, so
For the people
we've
who are
already.
listening who can't see, there's an absolutely beautiful visual here.
Yep, and this is from AI, but it's part of some of the designs that I've been working on. But yeah, hexagons are the best of gons. but these living organic places, the idea of what it would be like to rebuild a community from the bottom up, and in a way that, you know, isn't a Luddite vision, right? It's not a total return to some kind of pre-civilizational state, but is incorporating a lot of the lessons that we have learned, not just in terms of material science and building quality, but also in terms of like how it is we go about finding homes, right? Like the normal process is through some kind of mortgage. Typically, it's a mortgage process in the United States. And I think there's some pretty deep flaws with that, and that we can probably improve on that process. But so there's a home design that I've been working on that I'll return to that at some future discussion you want, that is really just a gathering together of a lot of different innovations that are taking place around the world. So so there are these questions. There's these persistent questions that we have, right? Like, they're the who, what, why, where, when's. And I think part of what we need to work on is finding out a shared historical explanation for where we came from. Take that very seriously. Take it not as a form of a competition, but as a collective work that we find out our story, right? As we're going through this, and just in general, these principles that underneath, I'd like to point out that, and I think I talked about this in my experience, that sacredness is a relational experience. That we can't expect that sacredness is going to be given to us. We can't expect that it's something we can demand, or that it's always going to be there. It can't be a guarantee, but it is something that we can invite, and something we can seek, and something we can be grateful for when we experience it, right? And to cherish it when it happens. So we need to remember that sacredness is this experience, and it's something that happens between us and something else and someone else. Relationship precedes agency. In order for there to be choice, there must always already be something which is relating. Relationship precedes agency. So even before we make a choice, we need to return to that and then feel the sacredness of it. And then furthermore, as we go forward in our decisions about what we do, love is what enables choice. Love is what gives us an opportunity, to feel safe and comfortable enough to choose, right? Because choice is about other than. If everything stays the same, there is no choice. But to step into that other than, like the real other than, the real unknown, like you're pointing to, that's hard. And that takes faith. And faith is part of love, right? Faith is loving being more than fear and trusting in it. So when we move forward, when we talk about these things, when we build things together, I think we have to remember that love is what enables choice. And that's something, if anyone wants to look into the work of Forrest Landry, he's a philosopher who encourages this idea. It's very important.
I'd also like to poke in here just a little bit with this whole idea of what precedes what. When Peterson did his lecture at Ephesus, when he got to the very end of the lecture, the point that he made was that meaning precedes matter, which is a very revolutionary statement, really, for a scientist to make, that meaning precedes matter. And in his newest book, We Who Wrestle with God, I always go to the end of the book and read the conclusion before I read the book. So I'm a bad girl that way. But at the end of the book, he talks about the fact that perception itself requires an aim, that you cannot perceive without an aim preceding the perception. And aim requires a belief. And that's exactly what you're talking about here when you say that relationship precedes agency and love enables choice. That aim requires a value system. Because if there's no value system, if there's no choice between what is better than something else, then you can't perceive anything. Because
That's right.
perceive narrows your vision. Perception requires a narrowed vision in order to perceive anything at all. And your vision is narrowed by your choices, which are based on your aim, which are based on your belief system. So it is possible to have a bad perceptual system, but then that's because your bet that's because your aim is in the wrong place, right?
Exactly. And it's usually because that aim has been given to you from some other place where that aim is good for that thing. It's a distributed will, and that will is not your own, right? And that it's not serving you. And you don't notice that until harm occurs. But yeah, that awakening to the understanding that we have to first see the good and the evil and then make mistakes in the choosing of it, right? That's the whole story. That's Adam and Eve. That's it. So yeah, but that's it, right? Where do we come from? What is the story of Adam and Eve? Like, what is the shared understanding that we have of the nature of consciousness and where it comes from, and why we're here at all? What is it that we're doing? We have this, we have a relatively split storyline at the moment, which is a scientific one and a religious one. And there's a deep divide between those two, which is usually used as a form of, I guess, in Verbeke's language, a philia nicaea, a way to engage in combat with the other to defeat them, rather than a way of trying to use it as a wise path forward. The ability to measure time, chronology, to discern features on ancient tools or bones. I mean, this is not the same thing as deciding what it is that you want to do with your life, right? It's not the same thing as understanding the deeply symbolic and how that relates to choice. Okay, so this is just these are the things that just relatively simple understanding of progression of mankind's relationship to language, right? So it begins in just the descriptive, this that written form. This is not exactly in order here. This is just the stuff that we need to get to the point where we are. You need tool use to make language, for instance, right? So these are kind of coming along at the same time. And then that is used to instantiate law. Tool and language is the utilization of law and how that enforces itself in the world, and that develops into ultimately religion and state. Language captures the religion. In Dawkins' language, it's this extended phenotype, right? It's this kind of cultural carrying capacity for wisdom that no single individual can hold, but it's supposed to gather together the values and instantiate them. And then the state, of course, as it began to develop, certainly in the Greek and then Roman expressions, was this further expression of how choice relates to the structure of your culture, right? And the early democratic expressions in Greek experience, and well, whatever we're going to call the Roman Empire and what it became, but yeah, and which would become the Holy Roman Empire at some point. So that is what. Oh no! Oh no! This is
Where did
that
Tyler
okay?
come
So
from?
we've already been through a lot of this stuff. Okay, so yeah, we went through a lot of this stuff here. So I was born in 1981. I'm kind of a Gen X millennial. We went over all this stuff in the story about where I came from. So this is kind of how I'm describing my experience on the internet as a second childhood, right? It's like this remembering of the joy of life and what it is to be curious about things. And then I guess just to briefly go through, this is like kind of the individuals I came into contact with roughly in order, that I've tried to help along the way in the story. As I was working on that pathfinding problem in the education aspect of it, I found Jordan Peterson's work, right? I found his awakening, well, his Maps of Meaning course. And that was it was about 4 or 5 months before the Bill C-16 stuff would ignite. And so it was fascinating to like watch that happen, right? As I was discovering his work. And what I discovered was that one of the ways in which I could probably help was to get into discussions with these young men that were gathering around what it is that Jordan Peterson was saying. And so that's where I first came into Discord. I downloaded Discord because I found out that people were gathering in a Jordan Peterson Discord. And I went in there and we had lots of conversations, and that's where I got to understand the general sensibility of the kind of youthful male energy that was gathering. The guy next to him, I don't know if you recognize him.
Is that Jordan
That's
Hall?
Jordan Hall. Yeah, that's one
Oh
of
my
his.
gosh, he looks so different. But then I saw something in his eyes and I thought, ah, yeah, that's Jordan.
Still got the same eyes. Jordan, so two Jordans, right? Interestingly enough. So after I started building up the initial what would become the Metagora project, the initial conception of a platform, an educational platform that was based on a Stigmergic model. So ant pheromone mapping. That's where I landed on it, right? So what I realized with the evaluation tools that were being used on YouTube and other social media websites were like pheromone markers. And that you could use those to assemble a kind of more ever more efficiently collapsed linear path through a given information complex to achieve an aim, right? So if you want to learn how to play the guitar, you look at you can watch one person's YouTube video, right? And maybe they'll be good for you, maybe not. Or you can let 10,000 people search through 10,000 different YouTube videos and all report on their interpretation of how good it was, right? And then you can collect that information, and over time you can develop curriculum pathing. So what I've done is I've taken a lot of the curricula that are posted by the universities. So if you want to get a particular degree in something, and I've streamlined, I've chopped out a lot of the fluff, the electives and all that stuff. And what we're wanting to do is condense the shortest possible path to achieve a particular skill or proficiency or knowledge state. Right, that's the idea, is that we want to condense that to the shortest possible time, because the traditional method of education is way it's woefully inadequate now for a world that's changing like beyond the rate that we can even measure now. So what we need is the ability to educate in real time on any given topic, to be quickly adaptable, and to give that as a as an opportunity for people, so that they don't have to be bogged down or locked into just more agency over how it is they learn more efficiently. So that's basically what a big part of what I built. And so when I built it, I reached out to Jordan, because I saw his work. I found something called the Deep Code on YouTube, and I found some of his Medium articles, and he very graciously accepted to talk to me right away. I was absolutely shocked. And the conversation we have is great. A lot of alignment in what I found out was being worked on out of California for many, many decades, right? These complex systems, dynamics, understandings, and attempt to engineer a cultural solution to the meaning crisis. That's really what was going on for a long time. That there was a kind of Club of Rome, kind of Aislinn Institute, Santa Fe Institute lineage that Jordan hopped onto, and that I became aware of at that time. And that the work I was doing was adjacent to a lot of the stuff there. So he invited me out to California to be a part of what they were doing. And I gave it some serious consideration, but there were a lot of reasons why I didn't ultimately accept that. One of which was I didn't think that they were going to be successful in the strategy that they were employing. I didn't agree with some of the values that they were professing, and I wanted to find a way to contribute to the overall movement and motivation, I guess, but to be able to do it in a way that didn't compromise the things that I thought were deeply important. Interestingly enough, Jordan has shifted his own track in the direction that he's going. But I'd be really curious to have a conversation with him now about what differences those are, and how that's going to play out in and this the still present needs of all the things that we have to work on together. I'll put a pin in that. But that's something I want to write. So the next guy, of course, everybody knows, Paul Van de Klee. I moved into his community next, primarily because he was just so rapidly attentive to Jordan Peterson, and he was just showing up in the algorithm everywhere. So I thought, well, this guy's curious enough about it, and just like all of us. So I had an early discussion with him before the Randos thing, and I went into his Discord and I tried to help keep discussion groups going around these values and principles that were being discussed in all this early Jordan Peterson culture that was around 2018, 2019, just leading into the COVID fiasco, which is where I would run into John Vervaeke. And so John, of course, came out with his Meaning Crisis series, and I could tell right away that he was, eager to be involved in very similar line of work, right? And that he had, in fact, been doing it for a long time. This is what's so fascinating about meeting all these wonderful people, is that you lose that sense of loneliness that you had when you were on your own path, struggling with your own ways of relating to the world. You realize that there's so many other individuals out there that are wrestling well with the world, so to speak, right? Trying hard to contribute to it. Even though we all have subtle disagreements, perhaps. Right around the same time, I ran into Eric Weinstein. I was right there at the start of his portal Discord. I became one of the moderators there. We would meet with Eric weekly, and I did a lot of really like experimental work in the portal community, building up different ways of relating, like highly intelligent but mostly antisocial young men in groups that they could work on complex problems. And there are a whole lot of failures, so many failures. It was in tandem with Lex Fridman, of course. Lex was deeply interested in it. As soon as we got Eric's community up to about 15,000, somebody knew Lex on Twitter, and so we had a like somebody he brought him in, and we had a big conference with Lex, and then we bootstrapped his community up and did a lot of the same things. Ultimately, both of them would decide that like their presence within social media was it's hard to maintain direct contact with your fan base, right? And I can go into the lessons that I learned observing up close, right? Like kind of the behind the scenes, what happened with these projects, but invaluable lessons. And the guy next to Lex is Tim Adelman. He runs a project called Voicecraft, which is another important feature of what I think is an important direction for dialogue to take, is the care that one takes for how you speak, right? That your voice should be as much as possible alive, that you're not regurgitating just the rote accepted understandings and propositions that you've digested previously, but even if it is based on those propositions, that when you bring it back, it's alive, and not just alive in the sense that you give it tonality or something, right? But alive in the sense that it's still questionable, it's still graspable and touchable, and that anyone who's willing to take a look at it with you can take it out and show them how alive it is. To really understand ideas to that degree, to care about them in that way, and then to afford yourself the capacity to speak in that way. Not everyone needs to articulate in that capacity, but for the people that do, it's a valuable and important skill to work on. And then I guess this is actually what brings me to this moment now, whereas previously I've been trying to assist other people's communities develop and learning from that process. Now I'm going to be going out into the world and attempting it myself. So I'm gonna try to shepherd a process and get it started, and hopefully it can grow on its own, right? That's the idea, that if it's alive enough, that that it's something that people can copy and make use of. So
So,
so that's where
do you have a YouTube channel, Tyler?
I don't really post anything on it. Some poetry here and there. Most of it's private, but yeah, I do have a oh that yeah, that reminds me. Yeah. There's a video we can watch together if you want. It's an art piece, yeah.
Well, why I'm wondering is because you've listed a number of people that you're hoping to speak to, and I just was wondering if you're going to do that on your own channel.
I will. I mean,
Okay.
I'll do it wherever, but I'll probably be having discussions. There will be ongoing group discussions. We're going to be streaming this stuff each week. There will be ongoing onboarding. There's all sorts of stuff. Yeah, but I'll have more of a YouTube presence at the same time. Yeah, so I mean, a lot of this is, I guess, yeah, this is going to be repetitive because we've covered some of it, but this mystery of the origin of life, I think, is one of the key things that we can grasp, that we can wrestle with together in dialogue. The nature of the origin of life, how it came about, its purpose, where it's going, is absolutely a worthy discussion, worthy to wrestle over. And so this quote from Francis Crick, one of the co-discoverers of the helical structure of DNA, is interesting, right? That even in the materialistic scientific endeavor, there is a state that we get into that requires us to believe in something that we call a miracle, whatever that is, right? Which is like, I really want to know what people mean when they say miracle, right? Like, what is it? If not anything, like, isn't everything a miracle? Like, from the bottom up, isn't everything a miracle? Because no matter how much I look at it and chop it up or bring it together, everything requires endless, like, chains of miracles. And so the way that we relate to that, I think, is really interesting. Like, how we assign that to the absolute or not, or matter, right? And that matter is, it's really interesting how matter is memory, right? It's mother. It's like fixed choice. It's like, it's ritual, right? It's continued. It's ritualized choice. Think of it that way. Right? It's like things that are in constant relation to the things around them in the same way. The more persistent they are, the more material they are, right? And yeah, so what is, oops, what is,
Matter is sort of like condensed time or concretized experience. And it's what has already happened, what has already been done, and then
yeah.
the next moment is the possibility. That leading edge of unknowing, which means if that's where poetry comes from, then everything that issues forth in every moment in time is actually an instantiation of poetry. And if you wind that back to the beginning, then that makes all of every instantiation makes all of it a miracle.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and to me, the thing that puzzles me when I hear scientists like, say, Carl Friston talk, and he says unabashedly that every living thing needs a map or a model of, needs an internal model of the external world that it inhabits in order to move at all, in order to move forward. Well, I'm sorry, but if you extrapolate that backwards as far as it can go, then origin of life cannot be what the scientists say it is, because it even at the very origin there had to be some internal model of the external world. Otherwise, there wouldn't have been no will to live, and without the will to live, there is no life. Whatever this accident they think happened, that somehow proliferated itself, the only reason it would proliferate would be that it desires life more than non-life. That desire comes from an internal model that has to be there preceding life. So, yeah, everything is a miracle.
And I know you love physics too, so yeah, so matter, I mean, we define these two different states in different ways, right? So matter is made up of what we call matter, like material stuff is made up of of quarks, and you need three of them, right? You need three always in order for it to be. In fact, you can't really get them other than in threes, except in special circumstances. That's fermionic stuff, fermionic matter. Whereas we also have bosons, that's light, and this is very different. Fermions and quarks, protons and things, they can't exist in the same spot. They can't exist in the same state. They are definitive, right? They have boundaries. They exclude. They take up space. Me, not you. You, not me, right? Light's not like that. Light is continuous. Light is overlapping. It's a superposition of possibilities. And so what we're talking about when we talk about the change in matter, right? Think about the historical scientific materialistic explanation for it is they revert to law, they revert to physical law as the primary generating function for all form, right? That somehow all form can be derived from a law, right? So that everything can be generated from the same like basic principles. And it's not entirely true, right? We actually know that's not true in a very rigorous way if we follow the logicians through Kurt Gödel, and we understand that there are true statements. So there are constructible and true things which can be built from simple principles, axioms, which cannot be proven to be true. There's a fund within the system, right? So there's a fundamental need to always be able to transcend or meta the system that you are within. And that ability, the existence of that ability, is a fundamentally boundary crossing phenomenon, right? It's not defined by previously existing rules. And so there is a way in which we create things which has nothing to do with a pre-existing rule. And it's those two things together, the two halves of those processes together in the same space, and our ability to choose between them, right? That is what we're confronted by. That there are these persistent phenomena, material states, memories, traditions, ways in which the world's handed to us, and then the way in which we relate to that and whether or not we change it, right? Do we need to change it? Why are we changing it? Well, that ability to change it into anything else requires for you to envision a new state. That's light, right? That's the visual process. When you shine that wavelength on the atom, right? Its ability to transform itself is directly proportional to the wavelength of the energy that is going into it. What it can become in material sense is related to the potential energy contained within the light that shines upon it. Right. And there's a relationship between matter and energy, which is really like at the bottom. But yeah, this slide is actually, again, we went through this a little bit before, but it's this idea, right? It's like, how do we relate to choosing this new thing? And how do we relate to our description of that process in language? How do we attempt to enforce it on others using that language? These are other aspects of like the question, the dialogue, the conversation, this great conversation needs to take place. I think we need to focus on this process of the creation of language, the enforcement of language, and how we're using that language to construct the world around us. And if we are more intentional about that and afford more people the opportunity to use their language to help build the world around them, not just a small subset of individuals, like narrow field, experts of various fields, or politicians or extremely wealthy business interests. But if instead we had a more decentralized, democratized process of utilizing our language to design the world around us, and that it was comporting to the values that we share, because if you take a look at the world around you in the socio-political landscape, most of the discontent is about the difference in values and the exercising of the or the coercion of other people's values over someone else's. Right? So when the minority and the majority have a disagreement, it's about values and then exercising of choice over the other. So What would it look like to have that be in a harmonious relationship rather than a antagonistic relationship like we have in the present party system in politics? That's another thing that we want to rewrite. Or if I'm hopeful, re-sing, right? Because we want to try to remember this octave. We want to get through the code here and then get back to the song. We want to kind of give up our agency back to we don't part of the American dream that went awry in a sense. Was the overemphasis on the you can do anything if you get enough money, right? Like that was a big part of what pushed out the kind of, I mean, I'm just going to throw some big bombs out here that a lot of people will agree with, maybe some others won't, but the way that the financial system fundamentally decoupled from the material substrate in the 70s, right? When the currencies were taken away from the gold standard. That I mean that's highly emblematic of like a persistent phenomenon that we've divorced our potential and innovative energies from the bottom, right? It's like this decapitated thing, the financial layer, the political layer. It's fundamentally decoupled from the lower layers, and to the extent that it ranges and chooses beyond itself. Right, it's missing the mark in the most serious way, and the fundamental resentments that build up because of that are, of course, what Marx explored. And so what would it be like to have a middle layer, which acts as the binding energy between those two functions, right? Which are the
So before you go on, I just want to ask you if you've had a chance to look at this guy.
oh, it's too small, but
Oh, sorry. It's Roy Sebag, The Natural Order of Money.
no.
He had a conversation with Jordan Peterson a couple of years ago, which is what encouraged me to buy the book. The conversation with Peterson is actually better than the book. But he goes back to that decoupling in the 70s, and he does a beautiful job of explaining the purpose of gold. I mean, it's a bottomless well of very interesting stuff. So I highly recommend Jordan's discussion with Roy Sebag.
Awesome.
Sebag.
Sebag. Got it.
Maybe it's pronounced Sebach or something. I don't know, but
Oh,
it's
no.
Sebag.
Yeah. All right. So that's where. Okay. So that's where I was going to insert the diagram for the website. Let me.
Well, so let's leave that for the next time we get together.
Oh
Is
wow.
your website the one that has the moving web?
Oh, I saw that. Is that what you, okay, you found no, that's fascinating. Yeah. So there is a Metagora consulting company that has that website. No, my website is themetagora.com. I
Okay.
think that's metagora.com.
Yes.
Yeah, I borrowed some of that code actually for the website because it's so awesome. Yeah,
Yeah, it's
that was a
very
beautiful
awesome
design.
because maybe before I go, I should just share that.
Yeah. Good idea.
Let's see. A little hard to see. You have to kind of tune in because it's not very high contrast, but you can see it's almost like the Wolfram thing of these nodes and edges, but they're continually moving and expanding and contracting and to me, oh, and I see you can get involved with it with your cursor.
Yep, it's
Look at
interactive.
that. I had never noticed that before. This is the kind of thing I've been trying to draw to explain how the principles interact with the elements.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, because in each case, like here's my cursor now, and there's a node to the left and a node to the right. If I move it so that I'm closer to the light or farther from the light, it changes everything around. Or if I have the nodes above and below, say, are orange and blue, and I move closer to the blue, then that creates a disruption, or if I move closer to the orange, that extends everything out. So every choice that you make in doing a painting, every place along the binary where you choose something affects every other interaction of every other principle and element in the work, so that your perception is always based upon the next choice, and then that choice affects everything else, and then the next choice affects everything. So this is, I mean, I would love to get this code.
I know. Is it, yeah. It, well, it's there. I mean, you can copy it. It's really cool. Yeah, I put it
What
in
do you
part of the
mean
website
you can
actually.
copy it? You mean
You can inspect. Yeah, you can inspect it and
you can
copy.
ask Claude to make a copy of this code for you?
Yeah, definitely.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Okay, well, that was my big aha for the day.
No, it's
I don't
it
know
was
if
it.
I'm smart enough to ask Claude to do any coding for me, but
Well, if
this
you need some
has
help,
been
I'm sure we can do it.
Yeah, this has been an absolute delight, Tyler. I'm so glad Emily introduced me to you, and
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I can't wait to see the website and have you go through it, walk through it with me.
Yeah, absolutely.
I am gonna send you a list of the names that occurred to me as we were talking of people that you might want to talk to about your project, and it's very exciting to think about the possibilities that are inherent in this whole project, really.
Yeah, and even more exciting that the possibilities are they're distributed, right? And as they gather, they make themselves known, and everyone finds their piece that they can take part in. And there's like this shared expression of appreciation and gratitude. It really is that that is what makes the nucleus of what I see happening in the TLC, right? That what we describe as the TLC. Is the relationships that are persisting because they want to be, right? And for no other reason really. So that what would it be like to have a scaffolding that allows for that to flourish and grow and be connected with the real world, right? In a way that we're not just giving up our agency to so many other people who are solving all these problems for us, but really taking a part in it. And that the part that we're taking is an artistic one, right? That it's fundamentally about creating from a place which isn't just understanding how propositions and rules can enforce a particular image on the world, but how we can give agency back to it, like how we can give birth to something, right? And how we can midwife that. And that's what I hope for us. And I know we can do it. Like it, we keep doing it every day. Individually, we keep doing it every day. That's why the whole thing keeps going. I know it gets a little disconcerting and despairing from time to time, and there are a lot of big problems, but certainly we have dreamed of an ending where we make it through. So, thanks, Karen.
Well, and it all goes back to the whole Wim Hof thing. Those problems are the opportunities. Those problems are the strengtheners. Those problems are, the catapult that flips things upside down in a good way. So,
The playground for our adventure.
yeah, it's been a delight. Talk to you
Yeah,
soon.
thanks.
Okay, bye-bye.